today, what a controversial new security law passed by the Chinese government means for the people of Hong Kong. Last week across Hong Kong, people began to hear news that shocked and frightened them.
I got a message on my phone from a friend saying, "This is the end of Hong Kong." So I thought, "Wow, what's going on?" I opened the link and it was a Chinese media report saying that there will be an announcement in Beijing in the National People's Congress about imposing a national security law on Hong Kong.
This new national security law bars subversion, acts of foreign interference and terrorism, all charges that have been used in mainland China to silence critics of the government.
There are some concerns that even calling for Hong Kong independence could be seen as secession. These crimes like treason, that can mean decades in prison.
It would also allow Beijing's security forces to operate in Hong Kong.
And really, at the time, we were all kind of in a state of shock and disbelief. We really didn't anticipate that it would come so quickly.
At stake are the very conditions upon which the United Kingdom handed Hong Kong over to China in 1997 under the principle of one country, two systems.
Now, Hong Kong people are to run Hong Kong. That is the promise, and that is the unshakable destiny.
Hong Kong was guaranteed its original way of life, including all the core values that we are familiar with, like all the basic freedoms of assembly, speech, publication, and the rule of law. So having national security laws imposed on Hong Kong in this manner is really spelling the end of all these civic freedoms that we've known.
Yesterday, the Chinese Parliament approved the controversial law, which could be enacted in a matter of weeks.
This meeting deliberates and approves a draft decision of the National People's Congress for establishing a legal system and enforcement mechanism for Hong Kong to safeguard national security. This is a major move to practice one country, two systems, and is also in line with China's constitution and the basic law of Hong Kong.
On the streets of Hong Kong, protesters demonstrated against the decision and were met by thousands of armed police. At least 360 were arrested.
The Hong Kong police fired pepper pellets at peaceful protesters this afternoon in what Amnesty International condemned as excessive and indiscriminate use of force.
Now many are looking to the international community for help. This week, the Trump administration said it will no longer consider Hong Kong as separate from mainland China and would revoke its special trade status, while the UK government has announced British nationals in the territory will have their visa rights extended if China continues down this path.
It now falls on President Donald Trump to decide whether to end some, all, or none of the U.S. economic privileges which Hong Kong enjoys now.
From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, could a new Chinese law signal the end of a way of life in Hong Kong? Fernie Yu, you report on Hong Kong for The Guardian. To put this new law in context, let's go back to 2019 and the protests that took over the streets of Hong Kong and dominated the world news agenda for months. Can you remind us why they began?
To start with, it was the Hong Kong government saying that we need to push an extradition law which would allow individuals to be sent to China for crimes that are not only crimes in Hong Kong, but crimes that are considered crimes in mainland China. And of course, that was very alarming. So on the day that the Legislative Council, that's our parliament, was supposed to have a reading of this bill, tens of thousands of protesters went outside the government headquarters and the Legislative Council to protest against this law.
Massive Hong Kong protests broke into clashes with police Wednesday as riot officers let off rubber bullets and streams of tear gas.
The protests did become very violent. How do you remember them reporting on them last year?
To start with, it was a peaceful protest. I remember being out on the Sunday before the reading of the bill at the legislature. It was huge. There were more than 1 million people, and the atmosphere was very energetic, jovial, completely peaceful. And then on the day that was supposed to be the reading of the bill, police started using tear gas.
Later, many remain angry about what they call police brutality because of the use of pepper spray, tear gas and rubber bullets on the tens of thousands who had gathered near government headquarters.
I think that really was the beginning of unresolved resentment that built up throughout the course of this movement.
I think what struck me when I watched interviews with the protesters last year, Verna, was firstly how young so many of them were and how they were willing to risk their lives to show how unhappy they were about China's encroaching control in Hong Kong.
Yes, I've interviewed some very young protesters, a 13-year-old, a 12-year-old, a 16-year-old, and really they're gripped by a sense of hopelessness. Because unlike their grandparents' generations or the parents' generations who came from China, they were born in Hong Kong and then they really see Hong Kong as a home. They're deeply attached to it and they're very unwilling to see the core values of Hong Kong being destroyed.
And the extradition bill was eventually withdrawn after months of protests, but the demands of those taking to the streets became about much more than that. And they showed the world just how much resistance there is towards China's interference in Hong Kong's affairs. Why did the protests eventually stop?
Well, number one, I think things kind of calmed down a lot towards the end of the year after the November District Council election.
There have been huge gains for pro-democracy candidates in Hong Kong's local elections after months of anti-government protests. The elections are being seen as a key test for the region's embattled chief executive, Carrie Lam.
People felt quite upbeat about the landslide victory of the pro-democracy side. The other thing being the coronavirus. There were still some small protests around Christmas time, I remember. But around January, when we knew about the coronavirus, everyone stayed at home and the protest movement sort of largely died down.
But some protests have been revived again over a proposed law that would criminalise disrespecting China's national anthem.
Football fans in Hong Kong have booed when the anthem is played, turning their backs. Now those who insult the anthem face $6,000 fines and 3 years jail.
Where did that come from?
That's always been in the pipeline, along with another bill to bar the desecration of the national flag. I think before the anti-government movement really got going, people were not, they didn't think it was a very, very large issue. But as things were built up, people feel that this is, you know, just another step of encroachment of China taking away the freedoms of Hong Kong.
And then last week, China announced they would be imposing new security laws on Hong Kong. And this has given protesters a whole new reason to be on the streets.
The sound of police firing tear gas and water cannon at crowds of protesters in the Causeway Bay area who've been out voicing opposition to China's plans to impose a new security law on the territory.
It's certainly the biggest protest we've seen since the outbreak of the coronavirus. I think the protesters are also very much aware that there is perhaps a limitation in terms of what they can achieve through protesting.
It felt very sad. There's a strong sense of despondency. A year ago, when people were on the street, they were very upbeat. They felt very hopeful and they felt this sense of solidarity. But on Sunday, people were saying that We know how helpless we are. We know that it won't do anything. It will probably even get worse, but we must come out to say something. And I was particularly touched by an old man. He said to me, "Why did I escape China 4 decades ago to come to Hong Kong?" Because I felt that this is a place of freedom and stability. Now, if you introduce this national security law, what's the difference between Hong Kong and China anymore?
Lily Koh, you're The Guardian's Beijing bureau chief. How has the Chinese government's approach to Hong Kong changed since last year's protests?
So for most of the last year during the protests, Beijing's approach to Hong Kong was basically to lean heavily on the Hong Kong government to end the protest while still not compromising the government's position. But what we're seeing now is Beijing is taking a more direct and interventionist approach.
When did you first hear that the Chinese government was planning on introducing these new laws, and what did you think?
A few days before the opening of the National People's Congress, we started to hear rumors that something big might come out of this year's session. It wasn't until the day before the parliament opened that we started to get concrete reports that this announcement might be actually Beijing forcing a national security law on Hong Kong. And I was stunned because I've been covering Hong Kong and China for most of the last decade, and this was not something that I expected, and it was very unlike anything I had seen before from Beijing in terms of its policy toward Hong Kong.
In light of the new circumstances and need, the MPC is exercising the power enshrined in the Constitution to establish and improve at the state level a legal framework and enforcement mechanism.
What do these laws actually allow China to do? What's so severe about them?
So we don't have the full details of the law yet, but what we do know is that, in the words of a draft document that we've seen, is that it is meant to prevent, stop, and punish things like subversion, terrorism, treason, and activities of foreign interference. What this could enable China to do is target protesters and people that would say that they're just exercising their right to free speech and free assembly. Chinese authorities and Hong Kong authorities, based on this law, could take that behavior as treasonous or subversion. They could use this law to target basically anybody that is a critic of the government. Another aspect of this law is that it empowers the Chinese government to set up national security agencies and a mechanism in Hong Kong. So that could be secret police. There was recently a proposal at the MPC this past week that there should be a Chinese court set up in Hong Kong manned by Chinese nationals.
To understand the context in which these laws are being made, Lily, I think we need to talk about the one country, two systems principle, which is how China governs Hong Kong.
The handover is done. The ceremonies and celebrations over. A century and a half of British rule in Hong Kong is simply history tonight. China is in charge now.
Can you explain what that means?
So the one country, two systems framework is meant to give Hong Kong a high degree of autonomy for 50 years after the handover. That in practice means that Hong Kong's institutions are supposed to be independent from the mainland. And it was set up this way because, as we know, Hong Kong was a British colony and its system was already very different from China's at the time in the 1980s when these negotiations were underway.
I think the main worries are that although the economic freedom is now well established, that the rights which people of Hong Kong have come to know as their own and as their rights might be constrained.
Hong Kong has a free, independent press. Citizens are able to organize and hold protests and voice their opinions in criticism of the government or government policies. And all of that is very different from how things are in the mainland.
And how within this is China able to make these national security laws? Is that not something that Hong Kong had already decided?
So under Hong Kong's de facto constitution, the basic law, Hong Kong is supposed to enact this national security legislation on its own. Some people would say that China is violating Hong Kong's constitution by pushing through the legislation this way. Beijing would argue that this law is being pushed through under a provision that allows for national laws to be implemented in Hong Kong. Legal observers have said that it is not supposed to be used this way. So the way that that provision has been used before, things like October 1st is China's National Day, or, you know, the territorial bounds of China and Hong Kong. So this is the first time that China will have drafted and passed a law that is specific to Hong Kong and enacted it in Hong Kong. What a lot of people say is that it really is just tearing up the one country, two systems framework.
I mean, have there been attempts in recent years in Hong Kong to write these national security laws there?
The Hong Kong government proposed its own national security law, but that law was shelved because of protests in 2003. So 500,000 people came out in Hong Kong, and that was the biggest protest since the 1997 handover.
Yesterday, the Executive Council, very early this morning, the Executive Council decided to defer the resumption of second reading of the Basic Law 23. I nevertheless want to emphasize one more time that enacting national security law is the constitutional responsibility of all of us.
It was really kind of a turning point for Hong Kong civic society. You know, if there was that much protest then what kind of reaction are these laws going to elicit in Hong Kong? And, you know, what are the next few weeks and months going to look like?
Why do you think China is doing this now?
So there are a couple factors for why China might be doing this now. One idea is that it is an opportune moment. The protests in Hong Kong have been paused temporarily because of COVID. And so this is a way to try to stop them before they start again. Also, the rest of the world is distracted, and some would argue that China is actually in a stronger position than a lot of countries that would condemn this measure and would stand up for Hong Kong. Another theory that has been floated is that although Beijing seems to have come out of the coronavirus outbreak in a stronger position, that actually this also is coming from a place of weakness for Xi Jinping, because even though China, you know, in the last few months has really been emphasizing its success and its victory over the virus, it was a disaster in China.
A diplomatic dispute has intensified between China and Australia. It started with Canberra calling for an international independent inquiry into the origins of COVID-19 last week.
Our relationship with China was good until they did this. Once we found out about this, look, we just made a trade deal with China.
So another thought is that actually, you know, after your protests, the Chinese leadership under Xi Jinping can't afford to have any more knocks to its authority and legitimacy. So this is also a way for Xi Jinping and the central government to reassert its authority and power.
Do you have any sense, Lily, of what people in China think about this?
So it's been interesting. Everybody in Hong Kong has been talking about this and it's all over the news. But in Beijing, it feels like it's barely made a blip. So it doesn't seem to have had much of an impact. But I would say that in mainland China, where most of the coverage of the Hong Kong protests and the situation have focused on the violence of the protests and particularly violent moments where protesters have been seen vandalizing property or surrounding somebody and mobbing them, that's most of the coverage here. And so most people don't support the protests in Hong Kong, and I would expect that they would see this as a good thing.
Lily, what's been the response from other countries to this move by China? I mean, is there any way that there can be an international effort to stop this from happening?
A lot of the protesters, their first reaction to the announcement was to begin lobbying other countries and try to get other countries like the US or the UK to put pressure on Beijing. So in the US, there's a possibility of sanctions, and the US is also threatened those sanctions.
In a statement, Secretary Mike Pompeo said that no reasonable person can assert today that Hong Kong maintains a high degree of autonomy from China, given the facts on the ground. The statement does not specify any detailed consequences, but President Trump has raised the possibility of sanctions on China.
China has said in response that is interfering with China's national sovereignty and that China would take countermeasures. I mean, I think that Beijing has seen that in the past few years, things that it has done have not elicited a strong reaction internationally, aside from statements and really just aside from the US and the trade war. So if anything, Beijing probably feels that the international community isn't going to do much to stop it.
After this, fear and more protests. Verna reports on the impact of China's shock announcement on people in Hong Kong this week. But first, if you like our podcast, we would love you to vote for us in the Listener's Choice category at the British Podcast Awards. It takes almost no time at all. Just go to britishpodcastawards.com/vote and type Today in Focus into the search bar. It would make the whole team very happy. Thank you. Verna, what's been the mood in Hong Kong since China announced these new security laws?
Despondency, panic, extreme sadness. The stock market tumbled that afternoon. And also I had a check on Google searches. And between 5 o'clock, shortly after the news media exposed that China is going to impose a national security law in Hong Kong, and 11 o'clock Thursday night, the number of searches for the keyword immigration had gone up 10 times. And people were talking about selling their assets, you know, dumping their shares, sending their children abroad.
As you've mentioned, Verna, China has tried to gain more power in Hong Kong for years and crack down on subversion. But does this feel different to those other times, to when they've tried to increase their power over Hong Kong before?
I think in the past, it's been using more subtle means to erode the freedoms of Hong Kong. But this time, it really is what has been described as a nuclear option. We knew that China would put pressure on the Hong Kong government to enact national security law, but we never thought that it would play such a direct hand in legislating on behalf of Hong Kong.
And what is the position of Carrie Lam, the chief executive of Hong Kong?
She's supporting appointed by Beijing, and she's come out to make statements to say how she's fully supportive of this move, and there's an urgent need because of the violent protests last year.
The third question, Hong Kong is a free society. Hong Kong will remain to be a very free society where freedoms of expression, freedom of protest, freedom of journalism will stay.
So there's always been this push and pull between Chinese governments and, you know, the people of Hong Kong. How do you think these protest movements have impacted on the way that China has treated Hong Kong over the years?
I think every time China tries to tighten the control over Hong Kong, then there's such a huge amount of pushback that China is further enraged by its reaction. I think the refusal of Hong Kong people to come under stricter and tighter control has given China more of a sense of perceived threat. It's a vicious circle, and then it wants to further tighten control over Hong Kong. So I think we're in a worse situation than a year ago.
What will become of Hong Kong's protest movement now, do you think?
I think it will get worse. I think people's bottled up anger and frustrations is building up. So I think people will continue to come out. Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of people, they say that they're not afraid of jail. I think we'll have to see. But even if the people are not coming out on the street, the undercurrent of anger and frustration is still there. It's simply gone underground.
Verna, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can read all of Verna and Lily's brilliant reporting at theguardian.com. Thank you for listening. Today's episode was produced by Sam Colbert, and the sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. Have a lovely weekend. We'll be back on Monday.